Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dana Frank, first started working in Honduras in 2000 when she was invited by the U.S. Labor Education in the Americas Project to help the coalition of Latin American banana unions develop a union label for the U.S. market. After that project fizzled out, she continued to travel to Central America to research women's empowerment projects in the banana unions. And she began another project focusing on the history of how the U.S. labor movement's anti-communist intervention in the Honduran labor movement during the Cold War. Just as she was wrapping up her research, the coup happened and her life changed. On June 28, 2009, at 5:30 in the morning, the Honduran military deposed democratically elected President José Manuel Zelaya Rosales in the first successful Latin American coup over two decades. Dana Frank tells the story of a repressive, brutal regime backed by the Obama administration with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. She also writes about the brave and determined Honduran resistance movement. We often hear about Hondurans fleeing poverty, gangs, and violence in the media, but we rarely hear about the causes of that violence. Well, Dana Frank lays it out in her new book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank is Professor Emerita of History at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she researches modern Honduras and U.S. labor history. Hi, Dana. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much. It's a great honor to be on the show.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I just have to say thank you so much for writing this book. You go into so much detail about what happened in Honduras and how we got to where we are today. And I just want to start off by asking you a pretty basic question. Anytime the media talks about the caravan, we often hear that the majority of the people on this treacherous journey north are from Honduras, and they're fleeing poverty, gangs, and violence. But we rarely hear about why there's so much violence. What are your thoughts about that narrative?
Well, you know, it sort of talks about Honduras as if it were some kind of natural disaster, or even can shade into a certain kind of historic racism, the notion that the little brown people, quote-unquote, can't govern themselves, when actually those gangs and that violence and the poverty, we can talk about the poverty too, are the direct product of the Honduran government and U.S. support for that Honduran government. So it's not like everything was perfect before the coup. Yes, there were gangs. Yes, there were drug traffickers. But what happened is the coup itself, which was a huge throwing out of the rule of law, a huge criminal act, including the participation of the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, and it just opened the door for criminal activity of every kind. There's been very little rule of law, impunity rate of about 95% for most of the years since then, which means you can kill anybody you want, and probably nothing will happen to you. That then opened the doors to the gangs to proliferate, to the gangs then to extort small businesses and to kill people who don't cooperate with them. It opened the doors for the drug traffickers. So now we have drug traffickers infiltrated into the very, very top of the government. People may have heard that the president's brother, Tony Hernandez, was recently arrested in the United States for drug trafficking and moving arms. And we have evident the National Minister of Defense and Security has been named for overseeing drug trafficking flights. The heads of the police are named in overseeing cocaine trafficking. And at the local level, the police are very much embedded with gangs and extortionists. So if you try to report extortionist activity by the gangs, the police just tell the gangs, and the gangs then kill you. So it's a state policy. It's a state practice that is producing the violence that people are, in fact, fleeing. And they are fleeing the violence from the drug traffickers, from the gangs, but also a tremendous amount of drug killing of women that has shot up. And so the domestic violence side of this is another piece that isn't getting reported. The so-called femicides have shot up in the years since the coup. So again, it's not a natural disaster. These people are refugees from policies of the Honduran government that have been that are supported directly by the United States. I don't know if you want me to talk about the poverty, too.
I definitely will talk about the poverty and everything you mentioned throughout the show. But I have to say, Dana, you know, the other thing you write about is the resistance movement. And I keep thinking about these lines in your book. You write, "So much of what Hondurans told me or what they did remains unsafe to repeat. All Hondurans who speak out against their government, its backers, or its enforcers are at very real risk of being assassinated at any moment, as are their children and family members who are often killed to send a message." I mean, that's just chilling to read.
Well, you know, I mean, we have these stories over and over again. Walter Trochas, who was the most important LGBTI activist and leader after the coup, was assassinated 6 months later in a clear message. Alfredo Landaverde, who was a former police inspector and congressman, was assassinated on December 7th, 2011. And most famously, Berta Cáceres, the indigenous and environmental and feminist leader, of, also of the resistance, who was assassinated on March 2nd, 2016. And especially, but all these killings underscore that anybody could be killed. And especially in the recent years, so much of the international solidarity movement has gone into trying to foreground and protect the work of leaders and also rank and file of the Honduran resistance, broadly defined, all kinds of social movements and human rights activists. And when Berta Cáceres, she was very famous. She had met with the Pope. She had won the Goldman Prize, an environmental prize in San Francisco, spoke at the Opera House. She'd been at a reception with Nancy Pelosi in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol. When they killed her, it was very clear that they would kill anybody. And, you know, this whole, it's like hard for me to talk about this, but the whole killing of children, I mean, I, maybe 10 months after the coup, I was in Honduras for the first time, and I was on the radio with an activist, and I tell the story in the book, named Pedro Brizuela, who was had worked with the Afro-Indigenous community for many years, was an old leftist, and we were on the radio together. And 3 weeks after that, when I was home in California, somebody killed his daughter in the two blocks away from where I had been staying. They opened the door and killed her right in front of her kids, and that was a message to Pedro, and this is a technique of killing people's children that's been used since, you know, since the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, that was a horrible story. Dana, before we go in depth about what exactly happened, I mean, we'd love for you to lay all of this out. I mentioned in the intro some of the work that you have been doing in Honduras since 2000. You helped the Coalition of Latin American Banana Unions develop a union label for the U.S. market. You researched women's empowerment projects. You've done a lot of work when it comes to labor. Give us a little bit more background about your experience in Honduras and how you became so closely tied to that country and its people.
Well, it was a great privilege to get to work with the banana unions and in this union label project. And I also ended up writing a book about women's projects in the banana unions that was really an organizing book and was also translated into Spanish and is available for Spanish speakers as well as English speakers so people can learn about these amazing feminist projects run by both women and men in the banana unions, especially of Honduras. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time in with packing house workers and finca workers, agriculture workers in the banana sector, and following around these activists for several years, and it was an amazing experience. So when the coup happened, I was starting to do this other research about Honduran labor history, but I thought, okay, it's been 10 years, and I don't know what I'm doing next. So when the coup happened, it was like, I opened the book with this phone call, and I have no idea what to do. And how do you stop a coup? I never did that before. I was never involved in direct anything in Washington or in foreign policy. I'd been a little bit involved in Central America stuff in the 80s. So part of the story of the book, most of the book is about the Hondurans and the U.S. policy and the Honduran government and the resistance and the repression. But there's these stories that I intersperse about my own experiences, but I don't want it to be, it's not especially a book about me, but me as an example of solidarity work and also using my own stories to pull you into daily life with activists, into the world of the both the joy and the terror of daily life as a in the Honduran resistance.
So let's talk a little bit about Honduras before the coup. Honduras borders Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. The population is just over 9 million people. Talk about what life was like specifically for activists before the coup.
Well, it's not like there was a golden age. I mean, the terrifying period was the 70s and 80s. During the 80s, maybe 200 Honduran leftists were assassinated or disappeared. But in the years, the 10 years before the coup, when I was there, most of those years, only 10 people were killed. Activists were killed in those years, mostly environmental activists and two labor activists. So that's a terrible record, but it's nothing like what it was afterward. And there was a functioning National Health Service for those in the formal economy. There was a functioning, somewhat functioning judicial system. There was a functioning state and a functioning judicial system, and in contrast to what would come after that.
I have a few friends doing some environmental work in Honduras, and they say you basically have to do your work underground. You just can't make too much noise. Does that sound about right to you?
Well, certainly that's true. Even if you do your work underground, you can get killed. I mean, Global Witness put out a report about 3 years ago saying it was one of the most dangerous places in the world to be an environmental activist. People do amazingly do speak out publicly, such as the people in Copin, the Lenca people in Copin, Berta Cáceres' organization. And a lot of these indigenous struggles are, most of them are about land rights, because there's this, what is called economic development in Honduras is actually destruction of indigenous and rural livelihoods through massive mining and hydroelectric dam projects that are just gutting the environment, but also gutting indigenous land rights. And there's legal obligations of consultation that are not being followed, and that's what people are struggling against. But they do it very publicly. I mean, the Tolupan people are also struggling. There are the Garif Afro-Indigenous Garisha people publicly struggle. What's amazing about this story of Honduras is, for all the horrors, there's also this incredible and brave ongoing activism that people are like, I'm going to do this anyway, and they're teaching their children to do it too.
Wow. So let's talk about what happened on June 28th, 2009. As you write, at 5:30 in the morning, the Honduran military deposed the democratically elected President Zelaya in the first successful Latin American coup in over two decades. What do we now know about who carried that out?
Well, it was clearly carried out by physically carried out by the Honduran military. But the Honduran Supreme Court, which had been handpicked the April before to support the coup, approved it unanimously, although some of them later recanted. And the majority of the Honduran Congress supported it. The actual leader was a guy named Roberto Micheletti, who then became the de facto dictator president immediately after the coup. We don't have an explicit documentation of the U.S. giving the green light to the coup. We do know from an article in The Intercept that a key embassy official left at the embassy, an embassy party with and met with the military leader of the coup the night before, and then came back to the party an hour later. But with or without that, we know people don't think that it would be possible for the plane that took the president out of the country to have landed at Sotocano Air Force Base, a U.S.-Honduran jointly operated military base, without U.S. permission. But then after that is where you really see the clear signals from the United States government. That after that is very quickly, after some initial sort of hemming and hawing, very quickly the U.S. treated Micheletti, the post-coup dictator, as an equal to the democratically elected president. They moved negotiations out of the Organization of the American States, which the U.S. didn't control at the time, into Costa Rica to negotiations that the U.S. controlled. They delayed and delayed and delayed, didn't demand that Zelaya be immediately reinstated, and then ran out the clock to the regularly scheduled presidential elections in November 2009. And almost all the opposition candidates had pulled out. Zelaya's own party had mostly fallen apart. The only man left standing was the other right party candidate, Pepe Porfirio Lobo of the National Party, and lo and behold, he won the election. But the army that had, same army that had carried out the coup, controlled the ballots. The vote counting procedure was controlled by the coup government. And Hillary Clinton put out a statement saying it's a beautiful, something to the effect of, it's a beautiful example of Honduran democracy in action, blessing that election. So once, and then it was like closed chapter, closed book as far as the United States was concerned and recognized Porfirio Lobo as a legitimate president for the next 4 years, although it took 2 years, two and a half years, a year and a half before most countries in Latin America would recognize that government.
Can you talk more about the significance of the Obama administration and, at the time, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton backing the coup, backing the new regime?
Well, you know, a lot of people were surprised by Obama because they thought, gee, maybe he was going to be a good liberal. This happened very quickly. You know, he was inaugurated at the beginning of, he'd only been in office for a year and a half. I think people had higher expectations of Obama. I remember arguing with people who wouldn't believe me that he was actually supporting this. Now, he immediately handed over to Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, but I do want to underscore that she worked for Obama, you know. So it certainly, you can see that Hillary Clinton, you can see it in her emails, you can see it in the WikiLeaks. You know, there's a WikiLeak in which the U.S. Ambassador Honduras says this is very clearly an unconstitutional coup, but she would never call it a military coup. And years later, when she was running for president, she actually said, oh, it wasn't, she basically said it wasn't a coup, and we never called it that, which is really scary. And she said in her autobiography, we helped get the question of Zelaya returning moot. Those are not her exact words. In other words, we got rid of the problem of the legitimate president by recognizing that the illegitimate election of November 2009. I just want to underscore that clearly Hillary Clinton bears this huge responsibility here, but so does Obama. But it's not just a question of what happened in 2009, because she continued to support and recognize this government and support the increased funding for it after a bit. But also Secretary of State John Kerry, now he had actually opposed the coup when he was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time of the coup, but then sort of slipped rightward after that when he wanted to be Secretary of State. And when he was Secretary of State, John Kerry too recognized the vicious coup regime. John Kerry to recognize the outcome of an illegitimate government. So another one. So it's not just about Hillary Clinton. It's also about John Kerry and, of course, about Trump, who continues to support the coup regime.
Today we're speaking with Dana Frank, Professor Emerita of History at UC Santa Cruz, where she researches modern Honduras and U.S. labor history. Her new book is The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And if you have any questions for Dana Frank, we'd love to hear from you. We hear so much about Hondurans fleeing their homes to take the treacherous journey north, but what about why there is so much violence, poverty, and gangs? What questions do you have about what has been happening in Honduras and U.S. support for the new regime? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dana, tell us a little bit more about President Zelaya. You write that he was a member of the Honduran elite. He came from one of the two traditional conservative parties that had ruled the country for decades on behalf of a dozen oligarchic families who controlled the vast majority of the economy. He was elected in 2006, but he started to take more progressive positions in 2009, influenced by democratically elected governments of the left and the center left. What do we need to know about Zelaya?
Well, Zelaya, again, he's no flaming leftist, but when he was stopping privatizations, which went forward, of state resources, which went forward after the coup. He had raised the minimum wage by 50%, and he was, again, starting to ally himself with these other left and center-left governments of Latin America. When the coup happened, the vast, huge alliances that composed the resistance across the political spectrum of the center and center-left, now that included members of his own party, included people that supported constitutional rule of law, and the LGBT movement, the women's movement, the Campesina movement, the labor movement, all sorts of folks. So all of whom got cast as Zelaya's supporters, but actually it wasn't so much that everyone was so loyal to Zelaya, but that Zelaya's symbolized constitutional order. Then he then starts responding after the coup to who's supporting him, including a lot of left governments and leftists in Honduras. And so his rhetoric moves left, although what he would actually done if he'd still been president, we don't really know. And then he eventually, when the National Front of Popular Resistance transforms, part of it transforms itself into a political party, Libertad y Refundación, Liberty and Refounding, or known as Libre. Then his wife runs for president, Xiomara Castro, and he becomes this sort of symbolic figurehead running that party ever since.
How do you explain why the coup happened? Why did they want Zelaya out?
That's a good question. I mean, then you're talking, I think it's a lot of factors. I think the U.S. is threatened by all those democratically elected governments that were moving left and center left in the hemisphere. And Zelaya was the weakest link in that chain. He himself personally did not have a mass base before the coup. And the U.S. knew that and was testing. I think they tested wrong because I don't think the U.S. expected the breadth and enormity and length of the ongoing resistance. Thought everyone would just roll over dead. Literally. But, you know, it's really also, I think it's not just about the coup, it's sort of the whole long-term support for the coup regime. And it's partly about the U.S. geopolitical power in the hemisphere. Honduras has always been the so-called most captive nation of the United States. The U.S. doesn't control a lot of other countries in the hemisphere anymore, and there's also strategically important a military base, Soto Cano Air Base, where the U.S. can land the big planes, and you could see at the time glimmers of what's become clear sense, which is the new Cold War with China. Now there's no Chinese involvement in Honduras that I know of, but the U.S. is aiming for this sort of new Cold War configuration, but it's also always considered Latin America, quote unquote, its own backyard, and under the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century, that somehow Latin America was supposed to just naturally be enthralled to some superior government of the United States at the point of a gun, and that power was slipping in Latin America. So the U.S. was reasserting that to the detriment of the Honduran people. People may also remember that Honduras was used as the base by the United States for a CIA-led coup in 1954 that overthrew the democratically elected socialist government of Jaco Arbenz in 1954, and Soto Cano was used as the base for the Contra war against the Sandinista government of Nicaragua during the 1980s. So the U.S. has a sense of ownership. But there's other factors in here. Certainly the United States Southern Command, which was fairly recently under the control of the same general, John Kelly, who's been Trump's chief of staff. And he was head of the United States Southern Command in the last few years until 2 years ago. And, there's certainly the Southern Command just has its own, they want their own power in the region, and it's an engine that runs of itself. And then a deeper level U.S. government interest in supporting these kinds of coups is an old story of making Latin America safe for transnational corporate capitalism. And anybody who threatens that is a threat to what the U.S. corporate-run U.S. government is defining as what U.S. interests are.
And you mentioned President Arbenz. For listeners who aren't familiar, he was the democratically elected socialist president of Guatemala.
Yeah, and that coup was definitely led by, was in service to the United Fruit Company, and the U.S. Secretary of State, John Dulles, was a former lawyer for the United Fruit Company, and the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles, was a former lawyer for the United Fruit Company. So that one was a very obvious in service to very direct, powerful U.S.-based corporation. Now it's more diffuse. It's more like this larger web of wanting to keep transnational corporate control in Latin America and wanting to have governments that are going to be open to that.
Today we're speaking with Dana Frank about her new book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Christmas music has become less of a genre and more of a season unto itself. Radio stations play our festive favorites nonstop, and artists continue to release new holiday albums in hopes of making their days merry and bright. Who's buying holiday music these days, and why? Next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock, right after your call here on KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also comment, post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will take a look back at this year's strikes. Over 20,000 teachers and school employees went on strike in West Virginia earlier this year, followed by a wave of educators across the country. And then recently, Marriott hotel workers went on strike and Kaiser mental health workers went on strike. So we're going to talk about the power of strikes. And then Thursday, we will open the lines to hear about your favorite nonprofits doing really good work at a time when so many budgets are cut for various reasons, including tax cuts for the wealthy. We're going to find out what nonprofits you really like, where you're giving, and what groups are doing very important work at this time. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Dana Frank, Professor Emerita of History at UC Santa Cruz, where she focuses on modern Honduras and U.S. labor history. Her recent book is The Long Honduran Night: Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. If you have any questions for Dana about what is happening in Honduras and why so many people are fleeing their homes to take the very dangerous and lengthy journey north, we'd love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Dana, we have an email from James, who sent in a couple of articles. I'll just read you the headlines. A U.S. cuts off aid to Honduras. It was in the Irish Times, and it says in 2009, the U.S. formally cut off $11 million in aid to Honduras in response to the coup that ousted Zelaya. Another Reuters story, Obama says coup in Honduras is illegal. And what are your thoughts about that? He'd like you to respond to these articles.
I hope we can talk about more recent stuff too, not just the coup in 2009. I think the U.S. had over $100 million in aid to Honduras. It did cut $11 million right after the coup, but it did not cut all the rest of the money. And U.S. law says that if there's quote unquote significant military involvement, the U.S. has to cut immediately all the money, which is why Obama and Hillary Clinton fudged that and decided to make a distinction and say it was a coup but not a military coup. This was at the time. So that was the pretext they used to not cut all the rest of the money. But then if you look at the funding level for 2000, that money was restored in early 2010 after the coup. And then the money, so I don't know it off the top of my head, it's in the book, the money starts to then really climb in the years since the coup. So it was almost like the coup regime was rewarded later, even though there was some initial action. You know, Obama did not say it was an illegal coup. The embassy official, Hugo Lorenz, did in a WikiLeak that wasn't public for maybe 9 months later. He initially said he hoped the Hondurans would settle this in a democratic manner, but he didn't actually make any statements after that. He certainly didn't say ever that it was an illegal coup. He did say this is disturbing or something to that effect, like the first or second days, but after that it was all Hillary Clinton who carried the ball publicly.
This listener sent an article from Reuters, and Obama said that we believe the coup was not legal and Zelaya remains the president of Honduras.
That was from the very, very first day. But after that was like the first or the second day after the coup. After that, he handed it over to Hillary Clinton, and they started saying things like, well, we hope it's resolved in a democratic manner. And then they moved it into those negotiations and said, and then waited till the election, the regularly scheduled election, and then recognized the outcome of the regularly scheduled election in November, that the coup itself was June 28. So after that, the U.S. did not act as if it was an illegal coup. They act as if the usurper, Roberto Micheletti, was an equal to the regularly elected president. The president Zelaya tried to return twice, and once the Honduran government didn't allow his plane to arrive, to land, and the second time in September he emerged in the Brazilian embassy. The U.S. could at that point had said, he's the president, recognize him, and never did.
You lay a lot of this out in the chapter, A Dictator Rises. And you know, what did you uncover about the State Department? You have a section in here. It says, in other words, the State Department was saying, we're going to look the other way. We're okay with this. We support Juan Orlando. Inside sources within Honduras told me in this period that the State Department loved Hernandez. He was young and could stay in power for a long time.
Juan Orlando Hernandez is the current president of Honduras, who the Hondurans widely understood to be a dictator. And he was a member of Congress at the time of the coup on a committee that approved the coup. When he was president of Congress in 2012, led the so-called technical coup that overthrew four out of five members of the constitutional part of the Supreme Court in the middle of the night and named new members completely illegally. And then that new Supreme Court in turn ruled that the constitutional ban on presidential reelection didn't apply, or they just chose to overrule the Constitution. They can't do that at all. You have to amend it, just like in the United States. And then that illegal Supreme Court paved the way for Juan Orlando to then illegally run for reelection again in 2017, and that was last year. So in his first election in 2013, we don't even know whether his first election was legal, because, of course, his party controlled the bookkeeping procedures then, as it did last year. Last year, when Juan Orlando was the illegal candidate president, and the opposition candidate was a man named Salvador Nasralla, who ran also in coalition with Libre, the party that came out of the resistance. The night of the elections, majority of the votes had been counted, the government announced that when 57% of the votes had been counted, the government-controlled election board announced that it was shutting down the election process for 2 days. It claimed that the computer had stopped, and then eventually started releasing the returns 5% at a time, and declared that President Juan Orlando Hernandez had won by 1.5%. That very clearly stealing of the election caused incredible, as a friend of mine put it, rage and grief on behalf of the Honduran people, and people poured out into the streets incredibly bravely, and at least 22, maybe as many as 40 people were killed. Bystanders and peaceful protesters were killed by state security forces using live bullets, which they hadn't even since the coup, sometimes just shooting randomly into crowds. And even the Organization of American States said that there should be a new election, and that's the call of the Honduran people right now, that Juan Orlando Hernandez is not the legal president. And the U.S. continues, as you say, to support Juan Orlando Hernandez, even though there's widespread evidence that he's stolen the election. And, you know, he's a military guy. He doesn't, not from the military, but he went to military academy. He's very close to the military. He ran his first campaign on the promise of a soldier on every corner as his militarized police, as a response to the vast corruption of the regular police. And those military police have killed people with impunity. He's a really terrifying figure. He controls the Congress, he controls the military, he controls the police, he controls the Attorney General. There is nowhere he controls the Supreme Court. There is nowhere to turn. You go to the streets and you can be killed. So it's really important to underscore, who is this government that the State Department keeps supporting despite overwhelming evidence of ongoing human rights abuses by state security forces? Also, most famously, in 2013, Juan Orlando and his Hernandez and his party stole as many as $90 million from the National Health Service, and the money went directly into his campaign and his party's campaign in 2013. The Attorney General's office has confirmed that the checks that document that are real, and that Attorney General's been sitting on that evidence since then. President even himself admitted that some of it was real and said, oh, I'll give it back. So there's this documented vast corruption and thievery by the president that's never been prosecuted.
Today we are speaking with Dana Frank about her new book, The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. And if you have any questions for Dana about Honduras, what has happened there, what is happening there, and why so many people are fleeing, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any connections to Honduras, if you're from there or you have family there, what are your thoughts about the coup, what has happened over the years, and where Honduras is today? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Tim in San Francisco. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Rosa, I listened to your show for years. It's very great, but I've never called before. Your guest, Ms. Frank, is it very informative? Has a complex political history I didn't know of Central America and Honduras. My question is this: I know a couple of people that I say more than 10 years ago. I think they were surfing enthusiasts. I guess it's a surfing paradise down in Honduras. One even opened a surfing school there. And so I'm wondering about American expats. Were either down there, or have they left, or are they still there? Or they feel safe? Why would they be there? That's generally my question.
There's not a lot of American expatriates in Honduras, and I think the surfing world is more in Nicaragua than in Honduras because the waves are not so good in Honduras. You know, there's certainly an expat community in La Ceiba and on the coastal communities in the more tourist areas, and some of those folks supported the coup. Some of them were opposed to the coup. It's not a very large population compared to the expat population, but, you know, certainly, there's people that are U.S. citizens married to Hondurans that live down there. There hasn't been an organized expat position about the coup. There was one woman who supported it, who very, very, very conservative website at the time of the coup. But, you know, I think that the main story is the Hondurans. There are also U.S. citizens and Canadians that have been back and forth to Honduras since the coup, reporting on human rights abuses, some telling these stories of the repressive government to the international community, reporting on it, documenting the killing of campesinos in the Juan Valley by state security forces and by the forces of Miguel Facuse, one of the richest men in the country. So there's also a lot of work by, and I would include myself in this category of documenting human rights abuses and reporting on the political situation in Honduras. So that's a whole category. And some of those folks live down there or go back and forth. People who do support work for the labor movement, people who do support work for the LGBT movement and the women's movement. So there are a lot of different categories of U.S. citizens, U.S. Americans that end up in Honduras, not just the tourist people.
Well, thank you for the call, Tim. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email your call at kalw.org. And Dana, you have just horrific stories of activists being killed. We talked about a few of them. But let's talk more about people who, as you say, risked their lives by going out on the streets after the coup. You report that demonstrations in support of constitutional order erupted all over the country. Various factions, LGBTQ, women's rights, feminists, so many different groups of people, labor. Just talk about what you experienced there within the resistance movements.
I want to understand that it's not just after the coup the resistance. There's also a huge middle class resistance in 2015. Mm. The of so-called indignados protesting against the stealing of the money from Social Security and calling for the ejection of the president and the attorney general, and all the protests last year against the election, all the protesting that goes on in indigenous communities. So it's not just after the coup. In the book, I really wanted to capture that post-coup resistance and the sheer audacity of it. And I first went back, and now it started from the morning of the coup. I myself first saw it in February of 2010, and I thought, this is going to be really depressing being here. It's going to be really scary. Instead, it was incredible how people had changed the music, the songs, the graffiti, the humor in the graffiti. And it was an enormous cultural explosion, and also this fantasy coalition of social movements that we'd like to see here in the United States. And it's, I think, a lot of reporting on Honduras is just sort of as if it's one unrelenting horror story, when actually there is this resilience and resistance and joy in life. And I'm always interspersing throughout the book stories of Hondurans dancing, because it's not, it's also that people seize the day and find strength in their community and in their culture. And you could totally see that, people's outfits, the way they sing and march. I mean, we see these kinds of resistance cultures in the United States too. It's not that different, but it's also specific to Honduras, because Honduras had not had a big armed struggle in the 80s. It didn't have a big mass political parties of the left like other countries of Central America and Latin America. So the basis was there in the social movements right before the coup, but it really exploded, and Honduras really surprised themselves in building this culture. And much of the resistance has been repressed since, but everybody has that memory of what they did and what they could, who they could be if the democratic space opened up. And frankly, if that they would be the first to say, if the U.S. stopped supporting their repressive government, both in terms of recognition, but also in terms of supports for the security forces that are blocking the opposition, broadly defined, and that includes all different kinds of stripes of the opposition, blocking the opposition from achieving the level of democratic debate that they would like to be able to have.
Well, that's directly connected to a question from our next caller. Let's go to Rick in Richmond. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is about quote-unquote U.S. interests. You know, over the years, we've heard we get involved in a lot of different places around the world. Often we're the ones who are creating the conflicts. But then it's justified that we're protecting U.S. interests. And I'm wondering if your guests can talk about what are the U.S. interests that we are supposedly protecting in Honduras. Why are we involved there in the first place?
Yeah, no, of course, who's the U.S. in that question? You know, I mean, it's not the U.N., the people of the United States, I certainly would say. It's, you know, we know that corporations control and certainly the military control the U.S. government. So as I said before, there's military interests that are an engine that run of itself. There's this broad interest, as I said before, in protecting corporate capitalism in Honduras. There's the so-called energy corridor. That's part of what these dams that are destroying indigenous territories are about. And there's also a project to build a big port on the Pacific side for export processing shipping. So you want to pay attention to the whole concept of economic development, because a lot of people say, well, the answer to immigration and the caravan is to pour a lot of money. It's that the United States should pour a lot of money into economic development in Honduras. And if you pour that money in right now, you're just giving it to thieves and corrupt elites in Honduras who will use it to further repress people and further destroy the environment. So it's also that the U.S., this is what the U.S. does. It works with regional elites. It works with transnational interests. You can see it more clearly with Canada, which is allied with the United States, and the Gildan Textile Corporation, which has hyper-exploitative textile factories and garment factories in Honduras, and a lot of the mining companies are Canadian owned. But it's also about this large, as I said before, this larger geostrategic project that the United States should dominate, and it should dominate in the interests of those corporate interests and with this giant military project. Because why do you have all this military? You have military in the region when who is the enemy in there? The enemy is like the local people in this case. You can say, oh, we're down there for sending their military to fight the drug traffickers, but the drug traffickers are the government.
Earlier, Dana, you mentioned the United States using the Soto Cano Air Base during the 1980s, and you report that on the eve of the coup, Soto Cano, staffed by 600 U.S. troops, remained strategically important to U.S. military interests in Latin America and the Caribbean. What is the status of that base today and U.S. involvement there?
Well, there are 600 to 900 troops there all the time, and the U.S. At Soto Cano Air Base, which is inland, it's near the capital of Tegucigalpa. There are also at least a dozen of these so-called lily pad forward operating bases, which are little bases that the U.S. runs drug trafficking operations out of. And there, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration of the U.S., used to work with Honduran security forces. We don't know what they're doing now. And famously, in 2012, U.S. forces of the DEA worked with the Honduran police and killed four Honduran civilians who were on a boat in the middle of the night, claiming they were drug traffickers, and injured four others. So U.S. forces also fire on Hondurans. And also the Marines have been coming to Honduras for the last 4 years or so in small operations for the first time in at least a couple decades. So you also want to see this sort of gradual of incursion of Marines. And, I track Honduran news every day, and you'll see these little defense, publication things about, like, exercises with a hospital boat. But those so-called humanitarian things are also about trying to convince Honduran people, as people in other parts of Latin America, that the United States' military is somehow a benevolent presence that's helping them out.
Can you elaborate when you say the drug traffickers are the government?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the pretext for U.S. pouring money into Honduran military in particular, but also the police, is that they're fighting drug traffickers. And we now have we've known this for many years, but now there's lots more evidence about drug traffickers at the top of the government. I mentioned before the president's brother, Tony, was arrested about a month ago in the United States for drug trafficking and also moving arms, and he's a Congress member from the president's ruling party. The Minister of Security and Defense, that means the guy in charge of all the police and military, who was a general until he was appointed, he has been charged by the same people in New York federal court. Rather testified against in U.S. federal court that he was overseeing drug flights. In January, the Associated Press documented that the new national director of the police and his two top lieutenants had moved cocaine and intervening in a case in which one of their allies had been arrested. So this is where you see this, that the drug traffickers and the Honduran military, and AP has talked about other evidence of the military using helicopters and planes to cross the border with drugs. So there's a lot in Honduras. There's always these, every few months these stories about, we've taken out, the military has closed all these little air bases in the woods, and now we've seized all this cocaine. But they themselves are the ones moving it in many cases. And the police are also involved in this at the local level, at a petty level. So we have this evidence that there's a very interesting article also by the Associated Press in February about how John Kelly, when he was the head of the United States Southern Command, work with Juan Orlando Hernandez, the current president, and if you read the fine print between that article, within that article, you can see that Kelly had to have known about drug trafficking and Honduran military. And of course, he's Kelly's chief of staff and is being very instrumental in Central America policy to this day.
Dana, you do such an amazing job of showing how, through all of this, the people are hit from all sides, their own government, the drug traffickers, poverty, the United States government. And, we're seeing the results of this. So many people fleeing Honduras. We're hearing sometimes about specific stories. I'm just reading some headlines right now. Honduran woman in migrant caravan gives birth. Honduran mother, son with Down syndrome, share asylum story. We read about the Honduran woman who was tear gassed with her children. I mean, what are your thoughts about what's playing out? And what are your thoughts on what we're going to see in the next year?
Well, first of all, things have to be so terrible for people to leave their own countries. They're not thinking, right. gee, let's go take advantage of riches in the United States. They're thinking, how do I keep my children from dying? How do I keep from dying? And you listen to the individual stories in these newspaper stories by beautiful reporting by U.S. reporters in English. They'll tell people that, look, the police tried to kill me. The gangs working with the police tried to kill me. There are at least three former Congress members from the opposition party who have been in caravans, who have been gotten death threats and had to flee. So it's very political. There's a woman who, you know, that she reported electoral fraud last winter, and then they tried to kill her. So what are these people, you know, there's so much of a dialogue in here about somehow these people are supposed to stay home when they're clearly refugees of this larger U.S. policy of supporting this government. So, you know, clearly we have to support the asylum policy of the United States, which at times have been a beautiful thing of welcoming people who are fleeing terror. The United Nations has understood these people as refugees since 2014, when we first had the first so-called crisis of unaccompanied minors. And not to see this as an alarming invasion, it's incredible the notion that these terrified, suffering women and children and men too, it's not just about women and children, that they are somehow a threat to the United States, is an astonishing feat of political propaganda. Well, you know, what is the solution? I mean, I think, first of all, we have to see these people as refugees and have generous immigration policies in the United States and have comprehensive immigration reform that includes regularized asylum processes for people who are fleeing terror, as they are in this case. So that you have to address that. You know, if you want to address the root causes, you also have to talk about the repressive regime. I think we have to, you know, call for a new election in Honduras so people can have a democratic processes to address what kind of government do they want and what kind of economic policies do they want for themselves. And they don't ever have that possibility because the United States keeps supporting repressive regimes that destroy the economy. And I want to say just before we run out of time something about all this the dialogue about poverty, because the Honduran government has been robbing the state coffers blind and destroying the state sector and working with the International Monetary Fund and other multilateral development banks that are controlled by the United States, imposing this neoliberal model that guts state services and destroys government jobs, and so then people don't have health care. A lot of jobs are lost, good union jobs in the state sector. But also what are called, and I talked about this before, you know, the so-called development sectors of tourism, mining, hydroelectric dams, and African palms and agriculture are actually destroying good jobs. So it's also like, what does it mean? You have to unpack what economic development means.
Mm. Well, Dana, thank you so much for your work and for writing this book. In the new year, we would love to have you back with a panel to really talk about solutions, because I think that's where this conversation really needs to go. What needs to change so people do not feel like they have no other choice but to flee their home? So thank you for your work.
Thanks. I just want to underscore that we're reintroducing the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act in Congress next year, and we need to get everybody on the Bay Area in that bill. We do have 71 members on it currently, but we need to get everybody on it again when it's reintroduced. So please, if people pay attention, there's actually something you can do very beautifully in the Bay Area to help this situation.
That's fantastic, and we'll definitely do a show also about environmental activists and what they, how they put their lives on the line by speaking out. Dana Frank is Professor Emerita of History at UC Santa Cruz, and she's the author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. If you'd like to podcast the show or listen to past shows, you can head over to yourcallradio.org. And thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.